Mixed Martial Arts Point of View podcast may not be suitable for all audiences. Viewer and listener discretion is advised.
Purchase your tracks today.
Welcome everyone to another edition of Mixed Martial Arts Point of View Podcast. Before we go any further, please allow me to salute the UFC for recently announcing the eventual induction of Hall of Famer Kevin Randleman. He is a former UFC heavyweight champion. I will delve more into that in my installment of the final edition at the close of the show. But before going any further, I just had to show love to Kevin Randleman. Joining me on this fine Sunday afternoon is my co-host, the one and only Deonte. We can be heard on such streaming platforms as iTunes, iHeartRadio, Podbean, and Spotify. And we're actually viewable on social media at Wrestling POV Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMA POV Podcast. Deonte, how goes it, sir?
Hey, no complaints, man. I'm having a pretty fairly decent week, man. So no complaints, man. I'm excited to get into some of the fights we're going to talk about this week. And I'm ready, bro.
I'm glad to hear that. Glad to once again have you join me.
And how'd you make out this week, man?
This week, it went pretty well, I must say. It was busy, having to cover three fights in a span of 8 days, as well as, you know, preparing for a show that involves covering two shows, as well as getting into other MMA matters. A bit taxing, honestly. It definitely challenged me, you know, as a journalist. But, you know, I enjoyed the thrill and I enjoyed the ride nonetheless. And I am thankful that we have made it to this point. So let me...
Hey, man, you big time now, brother. You big time now. You out here.
Hey, man. If I'm big time, you big time, man. We rolling together, brother.
Yeah, we out here. You know what I'm saying? Definitely. This pandemic has hit, man. I'm living differently out here, man. You know what I'm saying?
Indeed.
Was in the grocery store earlier today. I'm in line at the grocery store. This woman walks up to me. Excuse me. I say, yes. She says, your fly is down. I looked her right in her face and said... You're welcome.
Oh, so you so you actually expressed to her that, you know, she should show gratitude for the peep show that you gave her. Is that what that was about?
Hey, listen, man, you know, you got to take the gifts where you get them. You know what I mean?
Okay. I hear you. I hear you. Well, speaking of gifts and what should be taking, so on last week, we got into a discussion in reference to referees and the obligation that they have to protect the fighters that, you know, they officiate over during fights. And, you know, unfortunately, we saw something this past week in one of the two Jacksonville cards that completely went against the grain of what, you know, you expressed on last week and what many people feel. And that leads us to our MMA hot topic of the week. Who was at fault for not protecting Anthony Smith during Wednesday night's UFC Fight Night Jacksonville main event between he and Glover Teixeira? During the Anthony Smith, Glover Teixeira main event of Wednesday night's UFC Fight Night in Jacksonville, Smith endured a barrage of strikes that sent shockwaves throughout the MMA community. Second round, Teixeira landed a shot to Smith's eye that turned the tide of this fight. Keep in mind, prior to that punch in the eye, Smith was dominating Teixeira. From there, Teixeira continued pounding away at Smith, first on the feet, then to the ground. Smith showed signs of a fighter with fight left in him, which may be why referee Jason Herzog allowed the fight to continue until he finally waved it off with just 1 minute 40 seconds left in the fifth and final round. Still, Smith was being bludgeoned. There are two clips that actually capture, you know, just some of the madness that was involved with this fight. First, in between rounds, you can see Smith telling his corner he feels like his teeth are falling out. And his corner responds with, okay, breathe, breathe, just continuously breathe, breathe slowly, breathe deeply, you know, as in the process of preparing him to go out into, you know, the forthcoming round. from there, we see a clip. There's another clip that's out there where you see Smith handing his teeth, his two teeth that actually fell out, to referee Jason Herzog during the bout. Other injuries that Smith included in his fight, I mean, that Smith suffered in this fight included a broken nose, a broken orbital bone, a cut under his eye, and a busted cauliflower ear. About a day or so later, Herzog himself responded, basically saying that the sport of MMA is beautiful and it is a teacher. Some lessons are more harsh than others. He's seen a lot of opinions on what should have happened and who was at fault throughout that whole fiasco. He was clear in accepting complete responsibility for what happened and vows to make the necessary changes needed to better himself as a referee. Now that the table has been set, who would you, Deontay, say failed at protecting Smith? Was it the referee, Jason Herzog, or was it his corner? Was it both? Should MMA implement boxing's tradition of throwing in the towel for moments such as these? I'll go ahead and let you answer, then I'll get into maybe a couple of comments from fans, and then I will go ahead and give my take on the matter.
You know, I wondered about that as I watched the fight, the part about the towel being thrown in, because not being a novice MMA follower versus boxing, I did wonder about that as I watched the fight. What I will say is this, though, man. His corner let him down profoundly. First of all, there were two incidents that his corner, his trainer, his coaches, coached him on that. Not incidents, but two instances, I should say, his trainer coached him on, where I was confused. The first incident was when he told his I'm not sure who his corner man is, but the guy's name is. He gave him what I felt like was really confusing advice going into round three.
Okay.
He told him to dial back the power. No, first he said, I want you to be a sniper, right? So a sniper is somebody who takes the right shot. And when they take the right shot, it's a shot that is designed to kill. That is what a sniper does. So I interpret that as saying, you know, wait for your shot. And when you get it, make sure it's a kill shot, so to speak. Of course, we're not talking about literally killing someone. We're just speaking hyperbole. But that's what I interpreted that to mean. And then toward the end of the side, not toward the side, I'm sorry, but toward the end of the rest period before heading into round three, he said, I want you to dial back the power on some of your shots. Don't throw them at 100%. Throw them at 70%. So you're telling him to be a sniper, wait for the kill shot, and then absolutely shoot that kill shot. And then you're saying, you know, take some of the power off your punches, get it in at 70%. That was the first incident that I listened to the corner coaching him up, Coach Smith up, where I was like, that's so confusing to me.
Yeah.
And I felt like he probably would be confused by that too. And then you add that to the fact that the entire bout, his entire corner would not shut up the whole time. Throw this, throw that, do this, do that, throw that. Like, relax, man. Coach him up. Give him an opportunity to apply the coaching. The whole time you're telling him what to do, he's going to feel compelled to do that because you're yelling instructions at him while he's losing. So he's like, I got to win. So I got to listen to what they're doing while trying to evaluate what's happening in the octagon. So that was confusing too. And then the second incident that confused me, where I say his corner was to blame, was the incident you just brought up. The man told you he felt like his teeth are falling out.
Yes.
Literally two teeth fell out the very next round. He went to the corner telling you, I'm getting punched so much, my teeth are literally being dislodged from my mouth. He's telling you that as you're wiping his face down, giving him water, getting him prepped up to go back into the match. As a corner, you got to stop it. You got to say, all right, you know, you fought a good fight. You gave it your best. But tonight is not your night, man. We're calling it. Of course, the fighter's not going to be happy about that, but it's one of those instances where you have to save the fighter from himself. You can't tell a fighter that we're going to let you make the decision on when the fight should be stopped, because a fighter will go to the very end till they have nothing left, till all breath is gone out of their body. So I blame the corner more so than I blame the ref. I felt like the ref was watching intently while he was getting hit with blows, but I felt like that Smith was trying, and in times where he was on the ground, he was showing effort to try to get up. He was still trying to block punches. He still was throwing an occasional elbow, an occasional a fist in the face of Teixeira. He was trying. It wasn't like the Overeem Harris fight. It wasn't like that fight. So that was a difference to me. Like watching the Overeem Harris fight, I felt like that was a little bit of a different situation where Harris was kind of like just flat on his back, not showing any type of ability to get up or block anything. That was a difference to me. So I mean, but I'm pretty sure it's a mixed opinion out there, man. What do you think?
Okay, so I'm gonna get into some of the comments on the in the Facebook thread, and then I'll give my opinion on it. So first, Rick Serrano III, who, you know, produces and edits the show for us, said that his corner let him down, and he followed up with the famous Rocky gif, throw the damn towel. So then Rick chime in and says, I don't know if it's pride, but a cornerman needs to be strong. It's a tough decision to make, and you need someone who doesn't care about the repercussions, but who cares about the fighter's well-being. I know if Herb Dean was in that cage, the fight would have stopped at the opening bell, LMAO. And, you know, that in a sense is a jab towards Herb Dean and his ability to overprotect fights. But when it's all said and done, you got to respect Herb because, you know, he used to fight himself. And so he doesn't, you know, want to see guys get hurt. True. My personal take on it, I think that the blame has to be divvied up between both the corner, and the referee. And I say that because as a corner, first and foremost, he comes to you and he tells you, I feel my teeth are falling out.
Like literally.
And of course, you know, with fighters feeling the need to be tough and having a certain bravado about them and, you know, grinding things out and seeing things until the end, no fighter is going to say, you know, stop the fight, I'm done, I can't take anymore. But with him saying that he feels his teeth falling out, that is some sort of indication that he is giving you his corner to let you know that things have gone awry and, you know, this isn't good. Something needs to be done. Facts. And then in the following round, as soon as he's taken down and referee Jason Herzog gets within reach, he literally spat his teeth out, handed the teeth to Herzog. And for me, again, going back to the referee and the obligation to protect fighters, even in the midst of them getting beat up, you mean to tell me nothing about a fighter handing you his teeth, say to you, all right, maybe this needs to stop? I just feel like the ball was dropped on both ends. But I respect Herzog for actually addressing the matter a day or two after the fact. And in so many words, saying that MMA is a beautiful sport. But again, with it comes harsh lessons. And so I have learned from this, and I will do any and everything to, you know, better my craft as an official. I tip my hat to him for that. What I find amazing in a sense, and actually a bit troubling, is that his corner, you know, didn't come forth to accept any responsibility. But then again, I guess it's unrealistic to expect this corner to do such a thing. For me, my hope is that MMA does embrace the boxing tradition of throwing in a towel when their fighters are in an abnormal, you know, amount of trouble. I mean, make no mistake about it, once Teixeira landed that hit, there literally was no coming back for Smith. Now, don't get me wrong, you know, he did show an active ability to, you know, defend himself. And it wasn't like he was, you know, knocked unconscious or, you know, rendered to narcolepsy or anything along those lines. But he was not able to properly defend himself. Once he got in trouble, that was it. And he was unable to recover from that shot to the eye. So there was an open, obvious, overt display of an inability to defend himself. And somewhere between the corner and... somewhere between the corner and the referee, someone should have said enough is enough.
The way you put it so eloquently, man, it's hard to disagree with your analysis there.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for anybody to say if a guy hands you his teeth that you just say, okay, well, keep on, man. Right. What? He gave you his teeth out his mouth?
Yeah.
Like, come on, man. That's... you know, that's a sign that he ain't winning this fight. You know, I know we'll get into the fight a little more later, man. I took some detailed notes about the fight because it was an excellent bout, man. But
it really was. Go ahead, repeat that.
It's just hard to disagree with you, man, on that. Yeah. He handed him his teeth. I mean,
there's another, you know, element, if you would ever like to plug in that. You know, I didn't mention at first. So prior to this fight, like say maybe a month or some change ago, early April, there was an incident where an intruder had broke into Anthony Smith's home, putting him, his wife, and his daughters in danger. And so when the wife heard the intruder break into the house, she informed Smith, and Smith addressed it. And Smith and the gentleman, who, by the way, is Luke Haberman, who is a former standout high school wrestler from the state of Nebraska. He was hopped up on some sort of narcotics. I can't remember if it was cocaine or if it was a meth or whatever the drug was. It just gave him this abnormal amount of strength. And Smith said that was one of the toughest fights of his life. I mean, he's hit him with punches, elbows, knees, and a guy just kept coming. And he legitimately put up a fight where Smith was concerned about the well-being of his family and if he would actually, you know, be able to survive the altercation. Thankfully, he did get the better hand on the gentleman, and the police were able to actually come and get him and, you know, take him away. And I'm saying all that to say that Smith was probably thinking to himself, given that, you know, recent tragedy that he and his family experienced, that he wanted to find a way to get a win, you know what I mean, to kind of help him overcome that recent incident. So in that regard, I do understand his will and his desire to continue fighting, but it was just so evident and clear to me that after Teixeira landed that shot to his eye, he was pretty much out of it. So, I mean, there were a couple of things that came into play as to why he continued to fight on and wanted to do whatever he could to press on, but it was just unfair for him to take that kind of beating and to be bludgeoned the way that he was and, you know, have to be subjected to two entities who have the, I guess, prerogative, if you will, to make a call to say enough is enough. But, you know, they didn't at that moment have the wherewithal to make an executive decision.
I didn't know about the incident with the break-in, man. That's something, that's some altogether new information for me. That's got to be kind of, that's traumatizing, man.
Very.
How long ago was the break-in?
This was the first week of April, somewhere between April 6th and April 9th. And, you know, even to this day, he talks about how his family is still affected by it and how, you know, his daughters don't feel comfortable in the home. So, you know, he had something to deal with going into this fight, and I'm sure he wanted to get a win to kind of help him overcome that, or at least kind of, you know, push that, you know, to the back burner in a sense. But then for him to lose the fight the way he did, it's like, wow, another addition to the mental anguish that he was already going through coming into the fight.
Wow, yeah, that's a lot, man, to know that your family's back home and they don't feel safe in their own home. I know you're probably really worried about them.
Absolutely.
So yeah, that had to be in the back of his mind somewhere. But he gave a valiant effort, man. I applaud his effort. He didn't.
Yes.
He stuck it out as long as he. If you stay in a fight so long that somebody knocks your teeth out, and you're still willing to exchange blows, you're a soldier, man.
You really are.
Yeah, nothing to be ashamed of.
You really are. I cannot argue with it at all. Speaking of which, we're going to actually move forward into our ground and pound segment of the show and recap UFC Fight Night 1, which featured Glover Teixeira and Anthony Smith in the main event, as well as UFC Fight Night Jacksonville 2, which featured Alistair Overeem and Walt Harris, who also had a personal tragedy prior to his return to the Octagon. So let's get right into it. Again, Glover Teixeira defeated Anthony Smith by way of TKO from punches with 1:04 remaining in the fifth and final round. Deontay, what was your take on this fight?
All right, so going into the fight, the tail of the tape, you had Teixeira, 8th-ranked light heavyweight, facing Smith, 4th-ranked light heavyweight. Teixeira, 30-7, Smith, 32-14. Smith had the youth advantage. But there really was no other advantages. I mean, there was a two-inch height difference between Smith and Teixeira, but the reach was the same, so that kind of nullifies that a little bit. And then the weight was the same, obviously, you know, Smith has had more fights than Teixeira, but he was younger, that could kind of nullify the youth advantage as well. Yeah, even though he's younger, he has a little more wear and tear on his body from the fights than Teixeira did. The notes that I have here, man, first let me just start with Bruce Buffer, man. He's just way too hype. He needs to simmer down. Either he needs to simmer down or they need to pump some crowd noise into, because he was just like, bruh, nobody's here. Like, relax. Just announce the people, man. Keep it, you know what I mean? He was at like level 20 and everybody else was just kind of, all right, let's fight. So he needs to calm down, first of all, and I'll pump some crowd noise, one or the other. But no, just get it into the fight, man. All right, so let's go round by round. So round one, this is how I had it. All right, round one, I had it 10-9 to Smith. I think Smith in the first round, you could see that coming into the fight, his camp had the correct strategy for how to beat Teixeira, which is pump that jab in his face and connect with that right hand when you pumping that jab. Keep him away from you at a safe distance and just keep pumping that jab and keep hitting him with that right hand. The occasional kick to the body. He landed 7 solid right hand shots in that round. 2 kicks, one to the head, one to the body or the legs, excuse me. So it seemed like in that round, Smith had the perfect fight plan. And it seemed like Teixeira was waiting for like the right opportunity to throw a big shot or to get the takedown or the right kick. It just seemed like Teixeira was waiting on something. Or that's how it seemed in the first round. And then that strategy would come to play later in the fight. But Smith dominated. In my opinion, Smith was a clear winner of round one. I mean, he looked great in round one. What do you think?
I agree wholeheartedly. Smith came in with the mentality and the approach of, as you said, popping Teixeira with the jab, circling him, making himself a difficult target for Teixeira to hit, and staying out of Teixeira's reach, because for those who may not know, Teixeira is excellent in the clinch. When he gets you in his grasp, this guy can land repeatedly with some rather rapid and heavy shots that could end your night early. So for him to stay out of Teixeira's range and his distance, it was truly applaudable. The strategy was on point. It was excellent. And the way it came to fruition prior to the, I guess, turn of the tide, it was well done. It was calculated. It was on point. Like, you cannot argue or dispute how successful that strategy was, throughout the first round.
I felt like watching that first round, I felt like, okay, well, yeah, he's going to dominate this guy. He's going to really pop this guy to the eye, and he's going to really have a good fight and dominate him. I mean, he looked great. He looked like he had the right fight plan. But then, round number two, bro. Yeah. And round number two was going okay for Smith until it got to under 2 minutes, and Smith started to get a little tired. So the circling and keeping Teixeira kind of in the middle of the ring away from the cage, or away from Smith's back toward the cage, was starting to, he was starting to get tired.
Yes.
So he was allowing Teixeira to get closer to him, and closer to him while his back was against the cage. And then under 2 minutes, Teixeira unleashed a flurry. And when he unleashed that flurry, he connected with some really solid shots and some kicks. And for a few seconds there, he was really nailing Smith. And it was at that point, I felt like the fight completely did a 360 turn. Like, instantly, it was like, okay, well, now things are different because Smith is obviously tired. And Teixeira is unleashing a flurry here. And then it was a few seconds left in the second round, and Teixeira nailed Smith to the body with a spinning back kick. And I was like, oh, that's gonna hurt. He gonna feel that one when he go to his corner. He gonna feel that one. And I think that under 2 minutes in the second round, from that point forward, the fight had completely changed. I gave the second round to Teixeira. What do you think about round two?
I would say the second round went to Teixeira as well, because as you mentioned, you know, with Smith exerting all of the energy and sidestepping and circling Teixeira throughout the first round and second round prior to things, you know, turning for the worse, that resulted in fatigue. And that fatigue set up that spinning back kick, which caught Smith, which then segued into that, you know, left hook that caught Smith flush and clean in the right eye. And you could tell that some damage was done at that point, because in Smith trying to retreat and recover, he kept going back to that eye, covering it, checking it. So it was evident that even if there were some, you know, prior shots to the eye, but that one specific shot was altering, and it forever changed the outcome of that fight. And once he got hit, Teixeira had his way, and you know, it pretty much went downhill from there.
That's the way I say. I gave it a 10-9 round to Teixeira, and going into round three, you know, they pretty much one round apiece. I kind of had him even in point. And buddy, round three was worse than the last part of round two for Smith, man. Round three, I gave that a 10-8 round for Teixeira, because he just essentially, now this was the round we spoke about earlier where Smith's camp told him to be a sniper and then said, take some power off your punches. It was obvious at that point he had become gassed. He was gassed at that point. So he got dominated the entire round. He got dominated. He was on his back or on the ground the entire round, pretty much getting pounded. And I don't remember the last time I saw someone get that thoroughly dominated in an MMA fight, UFC fight. There was nothing from that round that I saw from Smith that said he was going to be able to turn this around and win the fight. It was a horrible round for Smith. Teixeira landed a clean jab and uppercut combo that really hurt Smith, and then he hit him with a left hook that just put Smith on the ground, and after that, it was a wrap. That whole round was a wrap. Like, put a bow on it. It was finished, man. What you think?
Actually, the third round up into Jason Hergal said enough is enough, it was pretty much a cycle. They will meet in the middle of the octagon. Teixeira catch with a couple of shots. They end up on the ground, and Teixeira just dominated on the ground with continuous ground strikes and mounted position. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thinking about what you said where you were questioning or trying to figure out when you actually saw a fighter, you know, spend that much time on the ground on the receiving end of ground strikes and just being, you know, outwitted on the mat. I would say, honestly, the last fighter that I saw dominated on the ground like that would be Conor McGregor as a result of Khabib Nurmagomedov at UFC 229 minus the submissions. But when it comes to, you know, ground and pound, it was just a one-sided bludgeoning that Smith could do nothing about.
I momentarily forgot about the domination of Conor by Khabib. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Heading into four, I now have it 2-1, with a 10-8 round going to Cesaro. He's in command. For all intents and purposes, I really feel like this fight at this point was over.
Yes.
I felt like at this point his corner should have really started to think about stopping it. Now, to Smith's credit, in three, he did block a few shots. He did throw an elbow or two, even though he didn't connect. He did throw a few little, you know, weak punches to try to get him off of him, you know, and he didn't quit. So I can understand them saying, okay, we'll give him, you know, a few more chances in the next round. But at this point, they really should have been really, really, really concerned about his well-being going into round four. How did you feel about it? How did you feel four went?
Again, I feel like four was repetitive of round three. They met at the center of the octagon. Teixeira landed some shots on him, got him to the mat, and it was just an absolute bludgeoning on the ground as a result of ground and pound. And I just felt like the fight as a whole went that way up until referee Jason Herzog said, that's it, enough is enough. We can't go on anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's a continued cycle.
Yep. I had four as a 10-8 round for Teixeira again.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And watching round four, and I replayed it, so just to make sure I was right about this, within the first 15 seconds of round four, Teixeira caught Smith with a huge uppercut that rocked him. And then from that point forward, he was just getting pounded for 4 minutes, for 4 minutes and 45 seconds. He was getting rocked. He was getting pounded. And I have it here in my notes. At this point, Smith was gassed, and he had nothing left. And his corner after that round should have said, you know, my guy's not coming out for round five. Yes. That's how I felt about round four. You should have said, no, I can't. I'm not bringing him out for round five. But, of course, as we know, they let him go out for round five. And as we know, round five, man, please tell the people what happened in round five.
Round five, it was more of a bludgeoning, and referee Jason Herzog couldn't take it anymore. I guess for me, it was one of those things where, why couldn't this match been waved off sooner? Why did Smith have to endure so much punishment, you know, for what, roughly what, 2.5, 2 or 3 quarters rounds? Why did he have to endure it for as long as he did? Again, you have two entities that should have had the wherewithal to say this fighter has had enough. It went on entirely too long, and it's just baffling that it, you know, the bludgeoning took place for as long as it did. It should have stopped much sooner.
Yeah, man. The only notation I have from round five is Smith needs new trainers. That's the only notation I have for round five. Literally. Like, because if you take a guy as young as Smith is and as highly ranked as he is in his division, you let him get pounded like this, it takes a lot out of him in terms of his mental confidence, right? So his confidence, which is mental, he got demolished.
He did.
He got dragged. And that takes a lot out of a guy. So if I'm Smith, man, I'm going home. I'm going to heal, be with my family, enjoy the money we just made. And I'm making plans to change corners. I'm getting me a new team. I need a corner that's going to help me not be gassed by the second round. You know, I need a corner that's going to look out for me, so to speak. I really felt like he needs new trainers. That's the only notation I have about round five, man. That's true.
It'll be hard to dispute that, truthfully, especially considering how things played out and the, you know, lack of negligence and protection for Smith. Yeah. Hard to argue that. So in reference to the rest of the card, let me just give some quick shot results. Ben Rothwell defeated Elvis St. Preux by way of split decision in his heavyweight division debut. Drew Dober defeated Alexander Hernandez via TKO from punches, 4 minutes 25 seconds of round 2. Ricky Simon defeated Ray Borg by way of unanimous decision. The best way that I could describe that fight, speed kills. I mean, it was an absolute track event, if you will. I mean, the speed that those two displayed, incredible. Andre Arlovski defeated Felipe Lenz via unanimous decision. Thiago Moises defeated Michael Johnson via heel hook, 25 seconds left in round 2. And what was so amazing about that fight is that Johnson actually had the striking advantage the entire fight up until the fight went to the ground. Moises saw an opportunity in a loose limb. He grabbed a hold of it, and he was able to secure the heel hook submission. Prelims, you have Sajara Eubanks defeating Sarah Marias by way of unanimous decision. Omar Morales defeated Gabriel Benitez via unanimous decision. And Benitez suffered this leg cut. Literally, the height of it, if you will, was about a foot long. I mean, it was literally a foot long cut going from the top of his shin to the bottom of the shin, and the depth of it, I mean, literally it was to a point where you could actually see the bone. It's absolutely gruesome. I mean, if you're interested, you could look it up or you could watch the fight over again. But to see that kind of cut as a result of leg kicks, or Benitez checking Morales' leg kicks, gruesome. Not for the weak at heart, if you will. Brian Kelleher defeated Hunter Azure as a result of a TKO punch, 3 minutes 40 seconds of round 2. And Chase Sermon defeated Ike Villanueva by way of knockout from an elbow, 49 seconds of round 2. So now we move forward to UFC Fight Night Jacksonville 2. And much like the main event of Jacksonville Fight Night 1, the main event here has a backstory in itself. For those of you who may not be familiar, roughly it was mid-October when Walt Harris's stepdaughter, Anaya Blanchard, went missing. And of course, there was a search for her. And as a result, he had to pull out of his original fight with Alistair Overeem, which was scheduled to take place December 28th at UFC Fight Night here in D.C. So unfortunately, the results came forth, and what happened was the young lady was kidnapped from a Chevron gasoline station, and she was making her way back to college after visiting family for a weekend. She was kidnapped from the gas station. The assailant, Ibrahim Yazid, he attempted to, you know, assault her, and she was able to actually put up a fight and take the gun away from him, but unfortunately he was unable to wrestle the gun away from her, shot her and killed her, severely damaged her vehicle, and, you know, unfortunately her vehicle and then she were later found, and, you know, him having to pull out and stay out of the fight game for, you know, some months to try to clear his head and get himself back into the game. It was a remarkable story as told by a quick ESPN documentary called Fighting for Anaya. For this gentleman to make his way back into the octagon, considering the loss that he and his family suffered, highly commendable. It's unfortunate that he didn't get the loss that he wanted, get the results that he wanted, excuse me, but, you know, he has reassured the fight community that he's not done yet, and I personally want to take my hat off to him to be able to deal with all of that and still have the heart to want to continue fighting. And he has, you know, made it up in his mind to dedicate his fight career moving forward to his stepdaughter, Anaya. And, you know, we here at MMA POV Podcast definitely wish Walt Harris well. Before we actually get into this fight in itself, what did you think of this story in reference to Walt Harris and, you know, everything revolving around and including his, you know, persistence and will to continue fighting?
No question he had to be stepping into the octagon with a heavy heart. The incident itself is not even a year old, right? So, and it's not...
Literally, just a few months.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, when you lose someone that you love and that you're very close to, you know, a stepchild, a child, it does something to you when you lose them in a natural way, meaning they die from either natural causes or somehow they get sick and pass away. It hurts. It weighs on your heart. But then when you factor in the fact that your stepdaughter or his stepdaughter was minding her business just being a human being, and some other human being decided that they had the right to snatch her up and try to do what they wanted to do with her against her will and then kill her.
Yeah.
That adds another layer of hurt that is difficult. I imagine, having never experienced that, but I imagine it's so difficult to swallow, to digest, to comprehend, to fathom. You know, words can't even express, I'm sure, the pain that his family feels and that he feels. So he had to be going in there with a heavy heart. And, you know, but like we all know, no matter what happens to us or what happens in life that impacts us, we all have to find a way to push forward.
Indeed.
As difficult as that may be. So I commend him, man, for being ready to re-enter a sport that requires total concentration, with that sure being heavy on his heart. So I commend him. He was a warrior and a soldier for even getting in that octagon.
I cannot agree with you more. I truly cannot agree with you more. Now to the fight itself. I have to say, Harris was on a mission. He came out and he swung and he landed some bombs on Overeem that sent him crashing to the mat. And, you know, he went into this flurry of ground and pound, and he threw some grounded punches onto Overeem, which would have ended most fighters' nights. But for whatever reason, Overeem was able to, you know, withstand the storm. He was able to endure it, and he was able to recover from it. He eventually took control of the fight himself, landed some significant shots on Harris, had Harris on the mat, and pretty much had him, you know, in a fish out of water type of situation. He was able to take Harris's back. He, you know, had a string of ground to pound shots upon him, and he was able to stretch Harris out, and Harris unfortunately was unable to cover. I mean, he had moments where he was able to, you know, come forth and throw some bombs and, you know, do what he can to defend himself. But I honestly think after that first series of grounded punches where he was unable to end Overeem's night as soon as he wanted to, I think it fatigued him. It was clear that it didn't have the same burst and the same explosion that he did when the fight started. And for Overeem to recover and to actually secure a win literally minutes before his 40th birthday, you have to tip a hat to Overeem. In addition, for him to have the respect that he did for Harris and even offer Harris to train with him moving forward, I mean, absolute class act. And I respect Overeem and actually like what he did for Harris, because he knows, like anyone else who knows his fight game, they'll see that piece of game tape on Harris and figure that it's a weakness of his and will try to expose that every chance he get. So I applaud Overeem for actually volunteering his services to help Harris handle himself in situations where his back is taken on the ground, so that, you know, he would know how to defend those and how to, you know, escape such situations moving forward. What is your take on this Overeem Harris main event?
Watching the fight, man, I was excited by the way Harris came out. I mean, Harris came out like bullet being shot out of a cannon, or cannonball being shot out of a cannon, like straight heat. Like, he was putting the press on him.
He
knocked
did.
Him down. Was on top of him. I'm like, oh, this is going to be a short one when I watch it. I'm like, this is going to be quick here. To Overeem's credit, he was able to get him back on his feet and reverse the entire first round. He was able to reverse the entire first round. And, of course, he dominated pretty much the second half of the first round. And then round two, He earned the stoppage. It was the kick that Harris threw an off balance kick early in the round two, and Overeem caught him off balance with a shot, and he wasn't able to recover from that. And once he got him flat on his belly and on his back, it was just all ground.
Yeah, got him on his stomach. Yep.
Yeah, it was just all ground and pound, man. It was clear to everybody, you know, watching it, both corners, both camps, as well as the ref. He doesn't know how to get out of this situation.
Yep.
And he can't take too many of these punches to the eye, to the jaw, to the head, to the face. We're not going to just let this man get brain damage right now, because Overeem is a huge human being. So is Harris, but Harris at this point is like a little child on the ground.
Right.
So yeah.
With Overeem having over 50 professional fights on his resume, as well as being one of only two fighters to have a win in four consecutive decades, he, along with Alexei Oleinik, having wins in the 90s, the 2000s, 2010s, and now 2020. Only two active fighters have wins in four decades. It just goes to show you that, you know, experience is everything. And Overeem showed why he is indeed the savvy veteran that he is.
Yeah, man. What was really interesting, going into the fight, before the fight started, when they put up the rankings and the records, man, Harris was the favorite in this fight.
He was.
Harris was favored to win. Harris is the number 9 ranked heavyweight. Overeem is the number 8 ranked. Overeem was 45-18. Harris was 13-7. Harris was the favorite.
He was.
And early on, it looked like the favorite was going to make quick work of Overeem. But, of course, Overeem, the savvy professional he is, based on his, three decades in the game, 90s, 2000s, now 2020s. So, 2010s and 2020, excuse me. Yeah, it's four. So, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, he obviously knew how to deal with that adversity, and he overcame. I would like to see Harris as a more seasoned fighter. I would like to see what he's able to accomplish if he is able to get the type of coaching that can help him work out of situations like that, that can help him not even get in situations like that. Because his size at 6'5", his length, he's very agile too. I mean, unfortunately, when he's on the ground, he wasn't very agile, but he's very agile. He's quick. He can move.
Former basketball player.
Yeah, somebody with that size, man. If you can coach him up right, I would love to see what he becomes. I think he can really be dominant, but he's going to have to be coached right. And I think another thing too, in watching it, I don't think he came in his best shape. He looked a little doughy. He looked soft. Yeah, he looked a little doughy. I think he could have been in a little better shape. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I think he looked a little doughy for a fighter. But I also think, like, when he threw that kick and he was so off balance, I just felt like, wow, okay. So if you're a fighter, balance is probably one of the most essential skills, weapons, or things you should work on during camp. For you to be that off balance that early in a bout and to throw a kick that wild like that just, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I could be wrong, but I just felt like he wasn't in top shape. And I can understand why. It's not like he didn't have a lot on his mind, a lot going on. So that was another takeaway I had from that fight.
Okay. Gotcha. I think with him, I think it was more so just a timing issue than, you know, his shape or lack thereof. I just think he mistimed the kick and he paid for his mistake. And, you know, doing that against a veteran of Overeem's caliber, you know, unfortunately, the hens came home to roost, if you will, and he paid for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Other quick hits in reference to Fight Night Jacksonville 2 includes Claudia Gadea beating Angela Hill by way of split decision, Dan Ige beating Edson Barboza by way of split decision, Christoph Jotko defeating Eric Anders by way of unanimous decision, Song Yadong defeating Marlon Vera by way of unanimous decision, and in the prelims, you have Miguel Beza, who beat Matt Brown by way of a TKO punch, 18 seconds of round two. Kevin Holland made short work of Anthony Hernandez, by way of knees, 39 seconds of round one. Gaia Chikadze defeated Erwin Rivera by way of unanimous decision. Nate Landwehr defeated Darren Elkins by way of unanimous decision. Courtney Casey defeated Mara Romero Barea by way of armbar submission, 3 minutes 36 seconds into round one. And Rodrigo Nascimento defeated Dante Mays by way of rear naked choke, 2 minutes 5 seconds into round two. Moving on to other news items. Per MMA fighter Steve Morocco, Tony Ferguson avoids orbital surgery after UFC 249 loss to Justin Gaethje. Tony Ferguson recently received some good news. He won't need to go under the knife. The former interim lightweight champion suffered a fractured orbital bone in a brutal loss to Justin Gaethje at UFC 249, but his injury would not require surgery. His rep Jennifer Goldstein at Belenji Group told MMA Fighting. The news on Ferguson's health was first reported by MMA Junkie. I've never suffered an orbital bone injury or fracture. I hope to never suffer one, but I'm pretty sure Tony is relieved that he won't have to go under the knife and he could just, you know, pretty much relax and take whatever time he needs before making his return to the octagon. Have you ever suffered such an injury, or can you speak on that type of injury, Deontay?
I can speak on it from having known someone who has had their orbital bone removed and then put back on, put back in place. But I myself have never had that occur to me. My mom had surgery in 2008. It was a form of brain surgery, but to get to where the neurosurgeon was trying to get to in her brain, the route that they took was on the side of her head, and to get there, they needed to remove her orbital bone and then had to put it back. Not sure how they did all of that, but her face had swollen up to about 2 to 3 times the size of her face usually. Wow. And they had to keep her sedated medically because the pain would be too severe. So, and I saw the pictures of Tony as well. That's how her face was kind of looking. Her face was even bigger, but her face was looking like that as well. So it was, you know, kind of, I have an idea of how uncomfortable that is and how discombobulating it is and how absolutely painful it is. But I haven't experienced anything like that myself. And God forbid I ever do experience anything like that. I hope I never, just like you, never ever get my orbital bone broke in any way, shape, or form. Please, God.
I cannot blame you whatsoever. And finally, in Grounded Pound, Abdulmanap Nurmagomedov's condition improves. So on April 25th, 2020, it was reported by multiple media outlets that Abdulmanap Nurmagomedov, who is the father of UFC lightweight champion and your boy Deontay, Khabib Nurmagomedov, was hospitalized with pneumonia and flu-like symptoms. Wednesday, May 13th, Nurmagomedov was flown to a military hospital to have his heart treated as a result of the effects from pneumonia. The heart surgery was performed, which resulted in Nurmagomedov going into a coma afterwards. There is good news when it comes to Nurmagomedov's condition. As of this past Thursday, May 14th, Nurmagomedov has awoken from his coma following heart surgery, with his condition still being serious yet stable. So it's definitely great to hear that Khabib's dad is doing well considering everything that he's been through. And for me, you know, call me crazy, but maybe there was some divine intervention involved as to why Khabib wouldn't have been available for UFC 249 and having to, you know, return to Russia. Apparently, you know, there was something unforeseen, that was coming down the pipe, informing his dad having to deal with pneumonia and heart surgery. But, you know, we here at MMA POV Podcast are thankful that Khabib's dad, you know, is trending in the right direction, and hopefully he will continue to trend in the right direction health-wise and, you know, get back to doing what he does best and, you know, ultimately leading to Khabib's eventual return to the octagon as well. What does this do for you as a fan of Khabib, hearing that, you know, his father had a health scare, but he's now heading in the right direction?
Well, as you know, Khabib is my guy. So, all things Khabib, I want to be positive. So, this is a positive development. And I'm very glad that his dad's okay. And then, of course, you add into the fact that we're going through this global pandemic and his symptoms were would leave you to believe that, you know, it could have been, or, you know, sounded like it could have been the coronavirus. But thank God, you know, it's not that. He's okay. You know, all things could be. That's my guy, man. That's my guy. He comes across as a very sincere individual. A hard worker. He just wants to fight people. I respect him.
That's it. That's all he wants to do. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to return with this week in MMA history, and then we're going to close things out with our final decision. This is Mixed Martial Arts Point of View Podcast with Deontay and Ant.
What's up, everybody? This is MMA Hall of Famer Randy the Natural Couture. Listen to Ant and Deontay on the MMA POV Podcast. That's an order.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. This is Mixed Martial Arts Point of View Podcast. So now what we're going to do, as promised, is get into our segment, This Week in MMA History, and then close things out with the final decision. So with that being said, first, there's May 12th, 2018, UFC 224. And by the way, just so you all know, this will be a championship-induced version of This Week in MMA History. May 12th, 2018, UFC 224. Amanda Nunes makes the third defense of her bantamweight title when she finishes Raquel Pennington by way of TKO. May 13th, 2017, UFC 211. Joanna Jędrzejczyk made her fifth and final defense of her strawweight title when she defeated Jessica Andrade by way of unanimous decision. Then May 14th, 2016, UFC 198, Stipe Miocic silences 45,000 fans in Curitiba, Brazil when she knocks out Fabricio Werdum to become, the UFC heavyweight champion. Anyone that follows this sport knows that the Brazilian crowd is the most ruckus crowd in all of mixed martial arts. I mean, yeah, they have witnessed, you know, some of their favorites take losses. But, you know, in response to that, they will boo, or they will give some of their, you know, ceremonial chants, to actually see Stipe silence 45,000 as a result of his knockout of Fabricio Werdum was absolutely classic. I mean, have you ever seen a situation, Deontay, in sports where it's combat sports, team sports, whatever, have you seen any situations that could be likened to this, where after a result comes forth, the crowd is completely silenced?
Yes, sir. Let me give you a recent happening in the world of sports last year in the world of Major League Baseball, where certain Washington Nationals went to Houston, Game 7, were down.
How about that?
And then, in the 7th inning, everything turned around. And they clinched the World Series in Houston, enemy territory. Houston fans were stunned, absolutely stunned. Another event to take it to the world of combat sports that I could think of where an audience was completely stunned. And when I say audience, I'm talking about those at the fight and those at home. Mike Tyson versus Buster Douglas. When Buster Douglas knocked out Mike Tyson, I know for a fact 95% of boxing fans were watching that, whether they were in the arena or at home watching pay-per-view, with their mouth wide open like, what did I just see? A dude who looked invincible just got knocked out by a dude we never even heard of. He was supposed to be a tune-up on the way to Holyfield.
Yes, he was.
He was supposed to be just a bridge between Holyfield and Tyson, a long-awaited matchup, a tomato can, somebody Tyson didn't even train for, take seriously. Not only beat Tyson, but beat him by knockout. His first loss, Tyson's first loss, his first knockout. Amazing, man. Amazing. As a professional, he did lose in the Olympic trials, but as a professional, Tyson's first loss, first knockout.
So just to give you an idea of how badly that loss affected me, I cried. Like, I literally cried like a baby. That was the first disappointment in sports that impacted me that way, that forced me to cry. That's the first sporting event where at the conclusion I was crying. Like, I've seen the Redskins lose plenty of times. I've seen the Washington Wizards, you know, lose. I've seen even my favorite college basketball team and yours, the North Carolina Tar Heels, you know, losing in championship games. I've witnessed it all. But that one was the first, and I could comfortably say only, sporting event that resulted in me crying when Mike Tyson was upset by James Buster Douglas.
It was unbelievable, man.
Indeed it was. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we move to the close of the show, the final decision. And I'm going to start things out, and then I will let Deontay, you know, close things out, and then we're out of here. So, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the show, I had to give kudos to the UFC because they recently, or as of last night, Saturday, May 16th, they announced the eventual Hall of Fame induction of former UFC light heavyweight and heavyweight Kevin Randleman. I know people would look at his record at 17 wins, 16 losses, and suggest, or maybe even question, you know, his place in UFC's Hall of Fame. But the fights that Kevin Randleman put up were, you know, nothing to frown upon. I mean, he kept you at the edge of your seat each and every time. Had a similar build to Mike Tyson. This guy has, you know, some footage that will absolutely wow you. I mean, from his slam heard around the world on Fedor Emelianenko, where he slammed Fedor on his head, yet somehow Fedor was still able to come back from said slam and win that fight by way of a Kimura submission, to his knockout of Mirko Krokop, literally rendering him motionless. You couldn't help but tune in to any and everything that Randleman did. He was indeed must-see TV when it came to the fight game. He debuted with the UFC in March of 1999. As I mentioned, he won the UFC heavyweight championship November 1999, held the title for a year until he ran into friend of the show, Randy Couture, and eventually lost the belt to him at UFC, was that 25? And then he was even a former Division I NCAA wrestling champion from 1992 to 93. So in my final decision, I just want to tip my hat to the UFC and thank them as a fan for inducting truly a legend of this game, Kevin Randleman. May he rest in peace. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, he passed away in 2016 as a result of complications from pneumonia, which resulted in a heart attack, similar to what Abdulmanap Nurmagomedov experiences. Difference between the two is, of course, Khabib's dad survived, Kevin Randleman didn't. So thank you, UFC, for inducting Randleman. Randleman, may you continuously rest peacefully and you know, just sit back and witness us celebrate your legacy once the induction takes place.
Absolutely. Rest in peace to that brother, and congratulations on his induction into the MMA Hall of Fame. And now, my final decision is actually away from the fight game, away from sports altogether, and or politics. You guys know I love talking politics, so it's away from politics too. I'm excited about the end of the summer because I found out this week that a film that I have personally been anticipating coming out since 1989 is coming out August the 7th, so I'm so hyped for it, but I have reservations. Let me explain. For those of us who loved the comedy films of the 80s, in particular, the comedy films of the comic who, in my opinion, owned the 80s, Mr. Eddie Murphy. The film I'm talking about was 1988's comic release with starring Eddie Murphy, Coming to America. It is a film about a young prince who wants to find a bride who respects him and loves him for the person he is, not for his money or his royal stature. So he ventures to, of all places, from his home of Zamunda, the mythical kingdom of Zamunda, to Queens, New York, to find his bride. And the rest is just pure, hilarious, comedic filmmaking. Coming to America is a classic. Well, this week I found out on August 7th, Coming to America, the sequel, will be released. Now, I know what you're thinking. Coming to America is a classic. Eddie Murphy is an all-time great. Why do you have reservations? Well, one, anytime you mess with perfection and try to one-up that or improve it or even try to follow it, the danger of failing and ruining the legacy is there. For example, when you discuss Godfather, you discuss Godfather 1 and 2, it's almost like Godfather 3 is not even in the family. Although it is, and it was a bad movie. It completely ruined the trilogy, almost, not completely ruined, but almost ruined the trilogy. Godfather 1 and 2 are still classics. So that's my hesitation. Now, the other part of my hesitation is the fact that it's not being released in theaters. It's being released via Netflix. Now, the people who are doing Coming to America 2, in terms of the writers, you'll be very familiar with the one of the writers who rewrote the script, a gentleman by the name of Kenya Barris. He has a show on Netflix called Black AF, which is, you know, short for Black as Fuck. Of course, you will know Kenya Barris from his hit show on network television, Blackish. He was the writer and creator of that show. Kenya Barris is a very good comedic writer. Okay, I feel good about that. The director of Coming to America 2 also directed Eddie Murphy in Dolomite Is My Name, which is also on Netflix, which was actually an excellent original film on Netflix. So I feel good about those two people. However, if you were to scroll through the Netflix catalog of original films, you will find some absolute gems, Mudbound, 13th, and some other good works. But a lot of their recent original films have been absolute garbage. So, I am lukewarm optimistic. I don't even know if that's a phrase or a term that is used in society, but that's how I feel. Optimistic because Coming to America brought me so much joy as a young man in the 80s who loved Eddie Murphy, loved comedy movies, loved Eddie Murphy's brand of comedy, Arsenio Hall, everyone who was in it, James Avery, John Amos. So everyone's returning for Coming to America 2. I hope it's as great as Coming to America 1. I'm optimistic, and I hope it doesn't ruin the legacy. If it does, I will be sad for a very long time, probably until the end of August. But as a result of that news coming out this week, man, I am cautiously optimistic, to use a sports cliche. That's my final decision today, sir.
Well, thank you for your final decision on today. And one thing that I love about your final decisions is that you touch on a lot of areas. You cover a multitude of industries and subject matter. So I truly appreciate that. And I must say, as a fan of Coming to America, I too have, you know, reserve optimism, but we'll see when the time comes. One thing that I don't have reserve optimism about, one thing that I am not lukewarm about, is my gratitude and thankfulness for being beyond this three-fight Jacksonville tour. Make no mistake about it, I love the UFC. It's probably my favorite sport right now, and I enjoy covering it. But truth be told, covering three fights in a span of 8 days can be taxing. And so I am looking forward to relaxing, easy, kicking my feet up, and knowing that there is a burden that I don't have to deal with, at least for another couple of weeks. So I'm going to enjoy this time off, if you will, and just relax and mellow out. Can I say, or is it safe to say that you share the same sentiment getting this, you know, three fighting 8 day span behind us, or run behind us?
It's a lot, man. It's a lot. I share your sentiment as a huge boxing fan since I was a little child. The MMA world is so different from boxing because,
indeed,
MMA has a fight all the time, and the matchups are always good. There's no competition between promoters, so to speak, for who gets the big fight, who gets the payday, who gets the money. It's all about the competition, pure and simple. And so you'll get great fights on every card, which is refreshing, and which is why MMA has grown in such popularity. But at the same time, it's like, all right, well, come on, man. Can I get some time in between fights? Can we get some time in between cards? You don't need to have a card on Tuesday and then Saturday and then next Sunday and then the Tuesday after that. We know y'all missing that money that hasn't been coming in due to this pandemic, but let's, you know, hold off for a second. Let us enjoy what we just saw and hit us with something even better the next time around. So, yeah, I share your sentiment, man. Hey, man, good show. Good to be with you.
Likewise.
Once again. Good to be with you once again. Thanks for having me, bro.
More than glad to have you, man. And I must say that the only reason why we got that run, if you will, is because UFC does have an obligation to meet the 40-plus fight contract that it has signed with ESPN. And so, you know, there's that sense of urgency of making sure that it obligates its part of the deal. So that explains that. And I wouldn't be surprised if we get some more, you know, before the year is out, but I'm not looking forward to getting such a run right away. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, this is Ant. Alongside me is
Deontay.
And once again, the show can be heard on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Podbean. And on social media, we can be found on Facebook at Wrestling POV Podcast and on Instagram and Twitter at MMA POV Podcast. Thank you once again for joining us. We hope you all have a blessed and safe week, and we'll be right back at it once again. May God continuously smile upon each and every one of us, and y'all be easy out there.
Be easy out there.